All right, Alexander, let's talk about the conflict in Iran, the war in Iran, and the wider war in the Middle East. Where we are on day, what day are we on, Alexander? 16?
18. It's
18?
18,
We're on day
day 18.
18.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so this is turning into a long war.
Yes.
That's the way it looks. I
Yes.
imagine with boots on the ground, if Trump does actually move forward with some sort of an operation which requires the Marines or special ops, and we actually do see the first 2.5 or 5,000 U.S. boots on the ground in Iran, I imagine then it's his fate is sealed when it comes to this war. I mean, we're in it
Yeah.
for the long haul. Until those boots on the ground, he probably still has some exits.
Yes.
I mean, how do you see this
Well,
working out?
if you recall a program that we did before the war began, we talked about Zugzwang, the fact that you get yourself into a situation, and Trump has got himself into the situation where whatever step you take, you're going to make your position worse. It's obviously it's a chess situation, but it can apply to conflicts like this. And it seems to me that what we said then about Trump potentially getting himself into Zugzwang, that is exactly where he now is. Now, the Israelis, who are his partners in this war, they do have a strategy, which is basically to continue the decapitation war, killing Iranian leaders. Just before we started making this program, the Israelis say, and I believe them, by the way, that they have managed to kill Larijani, the head of Iran's national, the security apparatus. I think Larijani, perhaps even
I haven't seen
intentionally,
that report. Has
no,
that
it is. It's in the Financial
really?
Times. It's
Okay.
in the Telegraph. The Israeli Defense Minister Katz has been talking about this today, that Larijani and the Basij militia, that they were both killed, the leader of them. And it's not difficult to understand how it happened, because there were big public processions in Iran a few days ago. Larijani, Pezeshkian, Araghchi, all of those people came out. They became visible. They participated in the protests. The Israelis and the Americans obviously are keeping track on everybody's movements. They will have seen where Larijani went. Larijani, in particular, would have been the person they were focused on. He must have known this. On this occasion, I suspect that Larijani knew what was going to happen, or at least knew that there was a high risk of what was going to happen. We're talking about people whose religious beliefs are consistent with seeking martyrdom. I suspect that this is what Larijani was doing. So the Israelis continue this decapitation strike policy.
Okay, can I just interrupt you there? I just wanted to read out to everybody that's watching the video
Yes.
from Al Jazeera. It's
Yes.
from all the big networks, CNN, Al
Yes.
Jazeera. They're all
Yes.
saying, breaking news, Israel claims it has killed top Iranian official Ali Larijani
Yes.
and Basij Unit
Yes.
Commander Gholam Reza Soleimani.
Yes. So
Okay, you're right. Yeah.
the Israelis, as I said, are focused on their continuing decapitation strategy. And of course, they are one of my own personal view about this mysterious invisibility of Netanyahu that so many people are talking about is because we're in that situation. It's a little bit like, the gangs of Chicago in the 30s or 20s and 30s. You go off and try and eliminate the other guy, and then you worry about the other guy sending his people to try to eliminate you. So Netanyahu is lying very, very low at this moment, and this is really what is going on. That is the Israeli strategy. The problem with the Israeli strategy is that even as the Israelis managed to kill Iranian leaders, some of whom clearly are putting themselves forward for death, which is, I suspect, what Larijani was doing. Even as they eliminate Iranian leaders, other Iranian leaders step forward and take their place. This is a decapitation strategy which isn't working. It didn't in the end work with Hezbollah in Lebanon either. There was lots of talk after the Israeli decapitation strikes that took place against Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2024, that the organization had been shattered. But what we now see is that it has reconstituted itself. And of course, they've done this against many adversaries in the Middle East. But the other side keeps going. So I think this was the strategy the Israelis sold to Trump, and to Trump's increasing dismay, it is not working. By contrast, the Iranians have a completely different strategy. I don't get the sense that they are really aiming to conduct counter decapitation strikes. They are hammering the Gulf producers, who are now in deep crisis, and they're keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed, or at least closed to whatever traffic they disapprove of. Now, the United States, Donald Trump, what he's been trying to do is he's been trying to find means to force a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, because this is the crisis for him. And that has proved impossible. All of the US allies have said, no, we are not prepared to participate. And I get the clear sense that the US Navy is saying no also. They do not want to put their ships, their warships, into the line of fire where these Iranians might be able to damage and perhaps even sink some of them. So this is Sukhsman, because Trump was sold on a strategy that the Israelis are persisting in, but which hasn't worked. He's got this problem with the Strait of Hormuz. So he needs to try and find a way out. You talked about boots on the ground. Boots on the ground, I think, would be a critical point of no return for Donald Trump domestically. It would be the moment where whatever was left of his base disintegrated. It would be the moment where you're quite likely to see protests in the streets, which we haven't yet seen in the United States so far. But all of the opinion polls, the reliable ones, show that this war is unpopular in the United States. So either he does this, he deploys large numbers of troops. And I've seen an estimate that if you're going to use a ground force to try to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, you would need at least 100,000 men to do it. And bear in mind, that takes a long time to put together, to deploy, to establish the logistics, to do all of those things. So we are probably at the, you know, looking at late autumn before it happens. The alternative is to try negotiations with the Iranians, but the Iranians are taking an extremely hard line. And with every one of their leaders who is killed, I predict that the Iranian position is going to harden further. You're going to have younger and younger people who are probably more and more militant, because that's the logic of this. And that is going to make it more and more difficult to negotiate with Iran. So it is an extraordinarily difficult position that Trump has maneuvered himself into. He has been a extremely skilled in previous crises that he has been in extricating himself from them, in finding a way out. But at the moment, I don't really see a simple solution to this one.
Not with Ukraine.
Not with you. No.
We'll do a separate video on Ukraine.
Absolutely. Exactly.
But yeah, he hasn't been skilled with Ukraine. His team is not very very good at advising him on foreign policy issues. That's for sure.
Yes.
But he's in a mess in Ukraine. and he's in a big mess with with Iran. So the strategies are interesting, the ones that you laid out, Alexander. Okay, the Israeli strategy is very mafia-like, as you said. Just try to decapitate the leaders until you get the collapse. Just keep on going and taking out the heads of the family, of the families, right? To use your mafia analogy, just keep on going after the heads of the family until eventually the organization falls apart. Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. The Trump strategy is, or actually the Iranian strategy is you hammer the Gulf countries, you close the strait, you create all kinds of economic headaches for Trump, economic catastrophes, not only for Trump, but for the U.S. allies, for the entire world, really, outside of, say, the BRICS countries, or at least Iran's allies, outside of Iran's allies that apparently are getting passage through the Strait of Hormuz. Your strategy is to create massive headaches, massive economic catastrophes for Trump and everyone in Trump's orbit.
Yes.
Whether they like Trump or not, whether the EU countries say this is not our war, or whether they say we're not with Trump, it doesn't matter. You're going to get smashed because you're part of the, let's say, the collective West. So that's the Iranian strategy. You hit the Gulf countries, you close Hormuz, and you create massive, massive headaches for the United States. Perhaps empire-ending headaches, perhaps.
Yeah.
Trump's strategy is you try and open up Hormuz.
Yeah.
Open up Hormuz, you get a lower oil price that buys you time and space to help Israel successfully execute their strategy, right?
Yes.
That's what a low oil price does for the United States, for Trump. If you can keep it under 100, it gives the United States, and by extension Israel, the time and space it needs to continue and try and hammer away at Iran's leadership and get that regime change.
Yes.
I mean, is that a summary of
well,
where
that is
we
a
are?
Summary, but that brings us back to the fundamental problem. How do you force passage of the Strait of Hormuz? The U.S. Navy clearly isn't keen. In fact, the reports say that they've actually pulled their ships further from the Iranian coastline instead of closer. And I mean, there are all sorts of rumors and speculations about, you know, what's happening with the ships, which, you know, I'm not going to discuss, you know, that there's been drone attacks. I mean, some of this may be complete misinformation, by the way. So let's not dwell on this. But they are clearly not keen on sending their warships into the Strait of Hormuz. And if you look at the geography, it is not difficult to see why. So forcing passage, breaking the siege, breaking open the Strait of Hormuz, probably it would need ground troops. Lots of them.
Yeah.
Not 5,000 lightly armed Marines, not the 82nd Airborne Division, which is also lightly armed and numbers another 7,000. You'd need heavy infantry, people with tanks and armor and that kind of thing, people who are prepared to fight a long, difficult battle, potentially with the Iranians on difficult territory with the seas all around. The US military, if they gave all their resources and all their thought to this, could do it, I believe, but it would not be a straightforward operation. It would be very, very high risk. There would definitely be casualties. There would quite possibly be a lot of casualties. And of course, it would also leave the United States in a situation where they would have to remain in the Strait of Hormuz indefinitely to keep it open, because realistically, a US military force is not going to battle all the way to Tehran. Yeah. So it's high risk, very complicated operation, but I suspect at some point, it's the one that Trump is going to drift towards. Because if the Iranians won't negotiate, and at the moment they're showing no interest in doing so, if the Iranians won't negotiate, if the situation with the energy crisis continues And it is now getting worse. I was reading in the British media this morning that there's now debates apparently within the British government about energy rationing. In India, which is of course an enormous energy consumer, there's articles in the Financial Times about the fact the crematoria are out of gas, that Indian restaurants aren't able to fry food. There's all sorts of problems of this kind, that officials are having to switch off the air conditioning. So this is a deepening crisis. It's going to get much worse over the summer, because especially if temperatures are high, that actually causes energy consumption to grow. It's going to hit tourism in places like the southern Mediterranean, because you're going to start to see airline prices of airline tickets surge upwards, because the cost of aviation fuel, which is highly dependent on oil from the Gulf, light crude from the Gulf, that's going to start rising. It's already rising, in fact. So he's got to try to find some way out. So it is, as I said again, as we said previously, it is Zugzwang. Now, there is one party that is trying to position itself to act as some kind of mediator, and which I think does have some leverage over Iran, and which might be prepared to help Donald Trump out of this mess. And that, of course, is Russia. And of course, we've spoken previously about Trump's call with Putin. There are some reports now coming out of Russia that say that Trump was very agitated and distracted during the call, and that Putin had difficulty keeping him to the point, which I can perfectly well believe. The problem for Trump is that obviously if he does go to the Russians, and the Russians do have leverage over Iran, I am one person who believes these reports that the Russians are providing intelligence assistance and advice to Iran. Why would they not in this situation? And the way the Iranians have been conducting their military operations is consistent with this. So the Russians do have leverage over Iran. But obviously, if they do agree to act as mediators, they will exact a price, and in any mediation exercise, obviously the United States will be entering into the negotiations in a much weaker position than the one it was in before the conflict started. Now, that nonetheless is probably the correct decision. That is a better way forward for Trump than doing what some people are talking about, declaring a unilateral ceasefire, stopping the attacks on Iran. It's far from certain that the Iranians would reciprocate. And of course, that would land him into all kinds of problems with the Israelis as well. Much better to start some kind of negotiation process. But at the moment, I can't see how that can be done without assistance from the Russians. And that comes with a price.
I don't see him taking that. I mean, maybe there's a small chance that he might, but I don't think his team, his neocon team around him, would allow him to take that that option with Russia, because as much as they hate Iran, they hate Russia just as much, and as much as they want to destroy Iran, they want to destroy Russia, and destroying Iran is a pathway towards for them. Is part of the plan towards destroying Russia and China and BRICS. I mean, they see everything as one package deal. So if we could pick off Iran, then we also weaken Russia, and we also eventually can make our way to China. So why would they even entertain the thought of allowing Russia to negotiate a settlement?
You are totally right about this. If we talk about someone like Lindsey Graham, the idea of Russia mediating the end of a conflict between the United States and Iran. I mean, it would be for him, the word betrayal from his perspective would not come anywhere close to describing what it would mean. It would mean one major enemy of the United States coming together with another major enemy of the United States to dictate terms upon the United States. It is inconceivable. And of course, it goes against the entire ideological premise upon which neoconism is built, which is that the United States, if it resolves to do anything, can always do it. There is no limit. There is no limit on the power of the United States or on the ability of the United States to do anything that it wants. So the neocons, a negotiated resolution of that kind would be even more disturbing for them, even more difficult for them to accept than an actual unilateral retreat, a defeat, if you like, because as we know, they can always find all sorts of rationalizations for any defeat. They can always say, well, you know, we weren't tough enough. We weren't hard enough. We should have bombed further. We should have attacked more. We should have imposed tougher sanctions on countries that dealt with Iran. We should have taken on the Russians and the Chinese all at the same time, as well as Iran. The reason we failed is because we showed a lack of will. That is an easier, better outcome for them, a straightforward defeat, than the kind of negotiated resolution that I was talking about. So absolutely, if Trump thinks of going down that route, he's going to be up against Lindsey Graham and all of the others. They'll be storming into the Oval Office. We'll have further meetings with all sorts of social media personalities and Fox News hosts.
Yep.
They'll be all there. They'll be saying, what are you doing? You can't even begin to think of doing this sort of thing. And I don't think Donald Trump is able to stand up to these people.
He couldn't stand up to the Europeans when it came to Ukraine.
No.
He didn't have the courage to tell the Europeans, I'm out of Project Ukraine.
Exactly.
Is he going to be able to tell Lindsey Graham and Waltz and Rubio and all of the Republicans in Congress and all of the Democrats in Congress? They're all going to tell him, no way. No. Are you going to have Russia mediate anything?
Yeah.
So they're never going to accept it. Ever. Exactly. Even if Russia is perhaps the only country that can provide a favorable off-ramp or a face-saving off-ramp to the president of the United States and get him out of this mess.
Yes.
As well as a face-saving off-ramp for Iran as well. I mean, for everybody, it could provide that off-ramp for everyone.
Yes.
But there's no way that Trump will
In a rational world, that's what would happen. Yep. Though it will be very, very difficult. I mean, for the Russians do have leverage over Iran, but
so Iran would. That was my next question. Do you think Iran would be fine with Russia mediating something?
Well, I don't think they'd be fine with anybody mediating. Right. I mean, to say it straightforwardly, I mean, I don't think they fully trust the Russians, for one thing. By the way, I think that feeling of mistrust, to a certain extent, is reciprocated as well. I mean, we shouldn't romanticize this relationship between Russia and Iran. There is a history of mutual suspicion. And my impression is that the Russians feel that the Iranians are very awkward customers who are very difficult to deal with. So I want to say that because I think it's something that people should have no illusions about. And of course, Iran might very well say, look, whatever pressure you put on us, we are not going to accept it. We are going to hold on. We've set out our conditions. We've said what those conditions are. We want all the American bases to close. We want the United States to leave the Middle East. We don't care if people tell us that this is unrealistic and utopian. It's what our demands are. We are in a position of advantage. We don't care if our leaders are martyred. We embrace martyrdom because that's our religion, that's our philosophy, that is our ideology. We're all prepared to embrace martyrdom in the same way. Martyrdom strengthens us. It doesn't weaken us. So they may very well turn around to the Russians and say, get lost. We're not interested. We don't want to negotiate. We don't want to mediate. Don't want to talk to the Americans. And that, of course, makes the whole idea of mediation by the Russians even more difficult, because there will be overwhelming, probably insurmountable opposition in the United States, but there might also be overwhelming, insurmountable opposition within Iran too. And some of them will say, we can't trust the Americans, we won't talk to the Americans. Araghchi has just said that this story, which again, I suspect came from the administration, you know, trying people closer to Trump, still trying to find some off-ramp, that this story that Witkoff and Araghchi have been texting each other, that this is all complete nonsense, that Araghchi has no intention of ever talking to Witkoff again. He feels that Witkoff betrayed him twice in negotiations. So it's entirely possible that that will be the stance that Iran takes, in which case we come back to this point. It's Zugzwang. What does Trump do? Inexorably, he's going to be pushed towards ground troops, which is a disastrous option. It's going to destroy his presidency. But I don't see how he gets off this completely runaway train, which he himself set in motion.
Yeah, the Iran strategy. I go back to what you said about Iran's strategy is hitting the GCC countries, keeping the Straits of Hormuz closed, inflicting a whole lot of pain to any country that is in the United States' orbit.
Yes,
but they do allow some tankers to pass. For example, they allowed a Pakistani tanker, I believe, this morning to pass the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes.
And of course, you have the reports that China is still able to get oil from Iran via the Strait of Hormuz. And I believe Araghchi, he has also said statements, the foreign minister of Iran, he has said statements that the Strait of Hormuz will be open to friendly countries or countries that are not part of the Trump orbit, the allies of the United States. I mean, he said that, right? So I go back to the Marines now, and I was watching a video from Brian Berletic. I'm sure you saw the same video where he talked about the 2,500 or 5,000 Marines that are being deployed to the region. Now, if you're Trump and you're the United States, you know, Trump said something very interesting during a press conference he gave yesterday. He said a lot of batshit crazy stuff. But he also said something interesting. He started to talk about chess and how this is a chess match, and he's dealing with very, very smart people on the other side, right? People with very high IQs. And he was talking about the Iranians, right? And one thing that he may be doing, going off of Brian's analysis, and I believe Brian actually said this, but I want to expand on it and get your thoughts, is that these 5,000 troops, if you're Trump and you're the Trump administration, you're saying, okay, I can't open the Straits of Hormuz just yet. Maybe these troops are going to go to open up the Straits of Hormuz. That's one option, just by ground force, by ground troops and just force, we're going to open up the Straits of Hormuz, or these special ops are going to take a Karg Island and we're going to force our way to open the Straits of Hormuz. Okay. But perhaps the other reason for the ground troops is what Brian said, and I believe you mentioned it in your video yesterday as well. perhaps they're saying, you know what? For now, let's just leave the Straits of Hormuz, just leave it there for now, for the short term, and let these troops cut off the tankers that are getting through so we can stop Iran's revenue there.
Yes.
The tankers that are making it through, because you get these Marines in a position where whatever does make it through, the Trump White House seizes those ships.
Yes. Yes.
So it's that type of chess match, right?
Yes.
You say, okay, these 5,000 are not enough to open up the Straits of Hormuz, and the United States knows it.
Yes.
But the 5,000 could be enough to block Iran's move of allowing some ships through, and then the next move is on Iran, right? What's your move? Because now we've cut off your oil. At least we cut off the oil that is leaving the Straits of Hormuz. We've cut it off.
Mm.
The United States. I mean, what do you think about all of that?
Well, I actually think that is much more likely what those 5,000 Marines are all about. And in fact, I did discuss all of this in my program.
Yeah,
my
that's
last
why I'm
program.
Saying it. I want to expand on Brian's analysis.
Just to make it clear again, it is from Brian.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, it seems to me by far the more likely idea. And that, by the way, may explain something else. I mean, we discussed before the conflict even began, that if there was a conflict in March and it dragged on, then Trump would have to call off his trip to China, because it would be terribly humiliating for him if the government in Iran was still in place and the situation in Iran looked stable and regime change had not been achieved. It would be very, very humiliating for him to go to China. And now, of course, he's already talking about calling off his trip to China. And of course, if he's going to start seizing tankers, ferrying oil. And at the moment, we're only talking about Iranian oil. I mean, that's the thing to understand. Iranian oil to China and Pakistan, and apparently one ship went to India as well. If he's going to start doing that, but primarily China, that is such a hostile act against China. That's another reason for not wanting to go to China in advance of, at this particular point in time. Now, it will put a lot of pressure on Iran, but I suspect that the Iranians, again, must have calculated this in advance. I mean, they must have expected, I think they're probably surprised, actually, that they've been able to send cargoes through the Straits of Hormuz to their various customers unimpeded up to now. And if there is a decision to put a blockade on them, I suspect they've prepared for it. Iran, it's important to remember, it's a big country, it's got a big economy. It can probably, for several months, absorb, maybe even longer, absorb this kind of pressure, economic pressure, especially if it continues to receive economic help from its BRICS friends. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese are saying that they will provide economic help, and the Russians are undoubtedly and unquestionably providing Iran with economic help, including natural gas, by the way. Russia exports natural gas to Iran, despite the fact that Iran is a natural gas producer. So, yes, it is a countermove that the United States could play to increase the pressure on Iran. But it's probably one that the Iranians have already factored into their calculations. The other problem with doing something like this, seizing oil tankers in that kind of way, is that, of course, it creates more tension in global oil markets. It interferes with the global supply of oil. Now, the US could try, after it seized these tankers, it could try to transfer that oil, say, to Europe.
Uh-huh.
And that might help to some extent with the situation there. But presumably, if tankers started to be seized in this way, traffic through the Strait of Hormuz would close completely it would only be for a very short time that it would be passing through and the US would be able to seize tankers, at which point, of course, we have further disruptions to global oil supplies and the energy price will simply go on rising and rising even faster. So this is the problem with that kind of gamble. It might increase the pressure on Iran, but it could also end up increasing the pressure on Donald Trump himself.
Well, why can't the oil be transferred to China? If you're the United States, you seize those ships and then you tell China, I mean, could Trump be looking at this from the standpoint of this gives me leverage over China?
Yeah.
I mean, does that make any sense to say, you know what, China, I now control whatever oil is leaving the Strait of Hormuz. I now control where that oil goes. It could go to you or it could go elsewhere.
Yes.
I believe that Trump, once again, in the press conference the other day, yesterday, even said as much. I believe he said that the Strait of Hormuz is closed, yes, Iran, but it's also closed because of us. Yeah. I believe he threw something like that out there, which was a strange comment, but he made it. And then, of course, you have the canceled trip to Beijing, or the delayed trip to Beijing, which to me indicates that Trump wanted to go to Beijing with leverage, and that leverage was going to be regime change in Iran. He doesn't have that leverage. So knowing Trump, he's looking for leverage.
Yes.
And where else can he get leverage? He can get it by saying, you know, forget the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like mafia thinking, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you're holding the Strait of Hormuz against me? Well, you know what? Forget the Strait of Hormuz. We don't care. We're going to demolish it. We're going to be done with it.
Yeah.
And now I control whatever ships are leaving the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes. The problem with this game, I accept these are moves.
I'm just trying to
moves,
to but see how they may be thinking. Yeah.
The problem with that is, of course, the obvious Iranian response to that is that if their cargoes with their oil are being seized, they stop oil exports.
Right.
So at which point there is nothing for Trump to seize and
sell. That's the counter move. Yeah.
Now, as for China obviously is not getting Iranian oil, which will be a problem for China, definitely. But China has, as we've mentioned before, we mentioned this before the program started, before the war started. We discussed it in programs on this channel and on previous channels before the war started. They were massively stockpiling on oil. They have 6 months, apparently, of stockpiles, so they can withstand this. And, of course, they have two other important suppliers of oil. One is Russia. We talked about Russia. And the Russians are very well positioned to continue to supply China with more oil. And no doubt the Russians will supply China with more oil. No doubt of that. The other country that is in a position to continue to supply China with oil is Saudi Arabia, which is now exporting oil through the Red Sea. And notice that Iran is letting that happen. I say Iran is. The Houthis are letting that happen. And I'm guessing that they've been told to hold back by the Iranians.
Exactly. Exactly right. They've been told to hold back by the Chinese. The Chinese told the Iranians.
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Just a final question. The topic of the depletion of weapons.
Yes.
Whether it be missiles on Iran's side or drones or ballistic missiles, whatever. That's the Iran side. The U.S. Israeli side is depletion of interceptors. But also air defense, radars, missiles as well.
Yeah.
What do you think about the other narrative, which is the depletion of weapons? Do you think there is such a concern from both sides? Maybe this is being played up too much. Maybe both sides have enough weapons to make this a long war. We're hearing September again as a timeline.
Yeah,
by the way.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. I think in terms of air defense interceptors, the situation in Israel and increasingly the US is becoming increasingly critical in the sense that I think that probably they have run out of TADs. Probably there were reports that were appearing in, you know, the military type journals, the K get published in the US, that the Israelis are now getting very concerned that they're running out of air defense interceptors, and they're coming to the US and they're asking for further supplies, and the US is struggling to produce these extra supplies of air defense interceptors. So I think those reports are true, and I think that's been true for a while. And I think that probably at some point within the next few weeks, we will never have a situation where there are no air defense interceptors at all, because there is continuing production in the United States. But we will have a situation where there are obvious gaps in coverage, and that will enable the Iranians to continue to do their missile and drone strikes. Now, on the Iranian side, what the situation is with Iranian offensive missiles is completely unknown. The Iranians say they have an enormous number of them. They clearly had many more than the Israelis that the Americans anticipated before the war. And the story that the Iranians are launching fewer missiles every day is simply not true. I mean, they launched a huge number of missiles on the first 3 days, but since then, it's remained steady at around 30 to 50 a day, which is a very high level of missile launches, by the way. So for the moment, the Iranians are able to sustain that. What the situation is with their missile stockpiles, I simply don't know. I don't think anybody outside Iran knows. The fact that they are maintaining their current level of launches suggests that they still have a very substantial stockpile, and that they're not worried for the moment about the number of launches of offensive missiles that they can make. And of course, with drones, it's much easier, because I think not only does Iran have huge stockpiles of drones, but they're relatively easy things to make. They can be made in factories, small factories. We saw this in Ukraine. They can probably go on producing drones, including even Gerand-type drones, for a long time. Now, where things are much less certain are about offensive missiles. Tomahawks, JASSMs, the various missiles that Israel is using. Now, the Americans and the Israelis have at various times suggested that they have complete air superiority over Iran. Pete Hegseth talked about heavy bombers, B-52s and B-1s, flying over Iran, dropping gravity bombs, of which the United States basically has an enormous stockpile. I mean, it would be very surprising if the United States ever ran out of gravity bombs. Despite what Pete Hegseth said, I've seen pictures now of the B-52s, and it seems that they have not actually been entering Iranian airspace. They've been launching missiles from outside Iranian airspace. These are JASSMs, which suggest that the skies over Iran are not fully under control, despite what Pete Hegseth said. Now, I presume, again, that there is a finite number of offensive missiles. I don't know how big those stockpiles are. At some point, we will probably see issues of depletion start to become a question of concern there as well. Now, the United States is never going to be totally without missiles. When we're talking about depletion of weapons, of missiles, the key thing to understand is that the US has been planning and thinking about a conflict with China. I read another article yesterday in the British media by Dr. Jack Watling of the Royal United Services Institute, in which he said that the strategic planners in the United States, and he's in contact with these people, are thinking of a potential conflict with China over Taiwan next year in 2027. The problem is that if the United States has depleted its arsenals of air defense missiles and offensive missiles to critical levels, then it is going to be very, very vulnerable in any conflict with China over Taiwan. And I think that is perhaps the most urgent worry. So far as I can see, the Pentagon has not come back to Trump and said this must stop. Things are at critical levels. But again, just as the price of oil is rising, so the depletion of the missiles is going to become a growing problem. And eventually, in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, who knows when, we're going to see all of these things come together and the pressures on Trump to find a quick, simple way out are going to grow.
Yeah, and the Pentagon would be very reluctant to tell Trump to stop, given their connection to the MIC. And I mean, I know there are very capable people in the Pentagon that will advise Trump correctly, yeah. But you also have the other side of the Pentagon, which I believe is the dominant voice of the Pentagon, which is the side that is obviously running Pete Hegseth, which is the side that is connected to the MIC. And I imagine the MIC is saying, no, keep this thing going. Give us contracts, more contracts.
Yeah. You're absolutely right about that. But I'm going to say something else. Even those people in the Pentagon who would want to come out and speak about this, they have a major disadvantage because they could say all of this to Trump, but they're not going to want to go out and say this publicly. They're not going to want to go to Congress and say, we've got to stop because we're fast running out of missiles. Because the very last thing they do, remember, these are military people, is disclose information like that, make it public, so that the Chinese know next year that the United States is in a position of critical weakness. Of course, China probably knows it anyway. But no military official in the United States is going to want to confirm that publicly.
Okay, Alexander, I think we'll end the video there. It's been a long video, but a good one.
Yeah.
You know, I'm listening to everything you're saying, and I've been listening to Brian Berletic's analysis as well. This is going to just go to the end.
Yes.
Until one of these countries is knocked out.
Yes.
I don't know. What do you think of that? That's the way I'm. I hope not.
No.
But I just can't figure out what the exits are, what the off ramps are.
No, I don't see any. To me, this looks like a long war. And one thing that might conceivably cause a change is if in the midterms the Democrats come in and they decide that, you know, they're going to use the war to put pressure on. But of course, the Democrats themselves are filled with neocons, as we know. In fact, they are the party in some ways which is even closer to the neocons.
Can I ask you a question? How do the economies of the world, how do the world economies survive until September or November?
Yeah. But I don't think anybody.
And I say Russia as well. I say all the economies because, I mean, you pointed out something to me in an email thread where was the situation of, okay, oil rises.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kaya Kallas is complaining, Russia's making money. Yeah. This is unacceptable. But there's a certain price where the oil goes too high.
Yeah.
There's too many shortages. The price is too high. And it doesn't benefit anybody.
No.
I mean, everything just falls apart.
Correct. Correct.
No one is saying that. We're saying that. You're saying that. No, I haven't heard anyone else say this because you have simpletons like Kallas who are saying, oh, well, the higher the price of oil goes, the more money Russia makes. So this is bad news, right? But I mean, look, if oil goes to 200 or 250 or 300, then we're all screwed.
Absolutely. This is, I think people just simply aren't getting. If oil reaches $200 a barrel, it is not going to stay there for very long, even if the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, because at that point, production around the world is going to collapse. People cannot conduct industrial planning and all of that kind of thing with $200 dollar a barrel oil. Either you let production collapse or you embrace inflation at rates which we haven't seen since the 1970s, which is comes with it a whole set of different problems. So what the Russians understand the oil markets very, very well, probably as well as anyone. And you see hints of this in Putin's meeting where he discussed the oil shock, the oil situation. About a couple of days ago, he had this meeting, which he said, you know, we got to increase oil, we got to export oil, we got to do all of these things. And he said, it's not going to stay there for very long. It's going to be temporary. And it's not impossible that we're going to see oil rise, reach $150 a barrel, climb even further, maybe to $200 a barrel. Then we see problems in the financial markets. We see a major recession. And in the autumn, we see oil prices crash. Oil prices crash below $50, well below $50. So what the Russians win on the swings, they lose on the roundabouts. They understand this very, very well. And it's something that people don't understand. Of course, the alternative, as I said, is to do what Biden basically did in his first 2 years, let inflation run surge. But of course, it would probably go much far higher because the prices would go higher altogether. But then, of course, that comes down to the same thing because at that point, if you're looking at a situation of global inflation, say 10%, 15%, 20% inflation, which we did see in some European economies in the 1970s, then of course $100 a barrel oil buys you less than it did a few months earlier. So people, I think, don't get this. It can't remain at these very elevated levels for very long.
Which is exactly why Russia prefers stability.
Stability, yes. Yes.
We'll end the video there, theduran.locals.com. We are on X, Rumble, and Telegram. Go to the Durant Shop, pick up some merch. We are also on Substack, so check us out there. And that's it. Take care.